Christmas can't get here fast enough because there's an awful lot of coal that's being shoved in stockings right now. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of our Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Oh, Barry, it is great to be back with you again today. Thank you for bringing up that image, and I'm going to tell a little story while we're at it. The little personal story. All my daughters are now in their 20s. Sure. But when they were little, I can remember money was a little tight, and we'd try to go out to dinner, and we'd go someplace where we could all sit down as a family and have something to eat. And my little girls were probably like 4 and 6, or maybe 5 and 3, two of my little girls. And it was around Christmas time, and my middle daughter was kind of just having a bad night. You know, she was, you know, that kind of stuff. And my oldest daughter was kind of an artist. She was very good. She could draw things, and her art was like very, very good. And somewhere I've still got the thing, but Liz sat down and started drawing this drawing on the back of a placemat, because they always gave you crayons at Bob Evans, basically.
Sure. Oh, and, absolutely.
Yeah. At you as a former manager of a Bob Evans know all about that. And she drew this picture of Santa, and Santa... complete with the, you know, the hat and the big black belt and the, you know, the standard accoutrements for Santa. And he's got like smoke coming off the top of his head, and he's got his hands on his hips. And he says, now my middle daughter's Rachel. She's the one who was having difficulties. And Santa is saying, he's got this stern look on his face, and he says, "No presents for Rachel, coal instead."
Oh.
And Rachel caught sight of that, and she went ballistic. So we kept that thing around. I'm not sure where it is these days, but I saw it not that long ago. I still had to laugh about that. No presents for Rachel, coal instead. Oh, Rachel was not happy. And unfortunately, she did not have the artistic acumen to fire back. So the Christmas season always brings up, if you have a family, it always brings up memories of funny stuff like that. I mean, there's something funny that happens to every family every year. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. It's that kind of stuff happens.
Absolutely, it does. But again, we've got an awful lot of things going on right now, amazingly, as we're getting into what we consider the holy season. Advent, reflecting on the birth of Christ and what that means for humanity, that humanity still can figure out ways of basically just picking fights. And there are a lot of people who are getting coal in their stockings this year over a lot of different things. But here's the one, and this one was delivered just Tuesday morning, Chuck. We're recording this on Thursday interestingly enough, the anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attacks. If you remember, December 7, 1941, yep, was when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and created chaos and gave Roosevelt the excuse for getting the U.S. into World War II. And some people think that the decision that was made a couple of days ago is going to be something that's going to get us into another war. And whether they're right or not remains to be seen. But on Tuesday, for the first time in forever, I believe, I don't know when's the last, I can't remember the last time when we actually did something like this as a country, but the President of the United States, Donald Trump, against the United Nations and everybody and their brother, including most of the leftist media, came out and publicly stated that the United States, as part of their foreign policy, is going to officially recognize the capital of Israel as Jerusalem. Not Tel Aviv, Jerusalem. Chuck, that's very significant, and it's a major move by the United States, by this president, because, again, it's something that most of the previous foreign policy decisions made by other administrations in the United States have always paid lip service to the idea of supporting and defending their friend Israel. And, you know, we've talked about the extent of that and the the eschatology, et cetera, behind it.
Yeah.
So go back to our archives and look that up if you want to, because we don't want to like bog down on that right now. But the recognition of Jerusalem as the official capital of Israel, and that recognition comes with the fact that he said that we are going to move our embassy to Jerusalem. Now, he said that he's not saying anything about the whole of Jerusalem, because obviously the Palestinians see the East Jerusalem as their capital, and he's not stipulating it, the whole of Jerusalem, but he's just saying we are going to, over the next 3 years, because that's how long it is going to take, to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. They're going to start making arrangements, and he said, and I quote, "I've determined that it is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. While previous presidents have made this a major campaign promise, they failed to deliver. Today, I am delivering." And he did. And, you know, he's issuing orders to make it happen. Benjamin Netanyahu, who's the prime minister of Israel, is beside himself with happiness because, again, this is something that the Israelis have been wanting to have settled. Because, again, one of the crux issues of the Israeli-Palestinian fight, hot and cold wars that they've been having for decades, is over who is Jerusalem Palestine or is it Israel? Chuck, do you see that? I see this. I mean, again, I know some of our friends with certain eschatologies are going to make so much more out of this than there is. But from a geopolitical stance, I think what Trump has done is to shore up Israel's claim to being a independent free state in the Middle East, which is not setting well at all with any of the Palestinians. Hamas has already come out and called for a jihad, you know, things of that nature.
That's not shocking.
It's not shocking.
And
of course,
move.
We've put our embassies in both that area and in Germany and in Britain. Turkey, Jordan have all been issued security alerts because those are major pockets of Muslim uprising that the Palestinian Muslims, if they call for a jihad against the United States, those could be some of the embassies that would be attacked first.
Well, I would say, the pot is officially stirred.
Absolutely. Well, supposedly the leftist media is wringing their hands that, the peace process has been destroyed. And there's some people who say with good reason. There's a quote here, and I'm on The Guardian's website, which is the British newspaper, theguardian.com. And basically they're saying, they got a quote here from the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, that says that the U.S. has effectively abdicated a role as a mediator in the region. And he says, quote, or at least their chief negotiator says, President Trump just destroyed any policy of a two-state solution.
Okay.
And I look at that and say, how so?
Well, because the answer is because they're not going to negotiate unless Jerusalem's in the package. That's basically
right.
What they're saying.
That's right. Basically, he called our Trump on it, and we are upset. Because, again, he didn't say that they couldn't have claimed a part of Jerusalem as their capital. He's just saying that we're recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which Israel recognizes. I mean, they don't like the idea. A two-state solution means giving up the seat of the Israeli government.
I would say, though, that no, if you were in their heart of hearts, the Israelis don't like the idea of a two-state solution.
No, they don't. Absolutely
at
not.
All.
I mean, and honestly, they would like to like clear out the Palestinians completely. And we get that. But of course, the Palestinians want to clear out the Jews completely as well. So, you know, I think you've got a situation here where this move might have been a opening gambit toward actually getting both sides to the table for peace.
Well, possibly. It could also have the opposite effect. But the fact is that what we're seeing the end of is the stake through the heart, finally, of the mandate mentality. And what do I mean by that? Well, after World War I, those areas after the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, Turkey, the Turkish Empire, if you will, Turkey, under the Ottoman Empire, ruled all those areas, Iraq, Syria, Arabia, the whole Arabian Peninsula, what became Israel, Lebanon, all that area. And after World War One, and the defeat and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, the sick man of Europe, as it was known at the time, those areas were divvied up, despite the fact that especially the British were heavily involved, the British and the French were heavily involved in telling all those peoples in all those areas they were going to be given independence. And instead of independence, what they got was what they called mandates. In other words, those areas were divided up into spheres of influence under the nominal rule by different countries, and Britain and France were the main ones. Russia was supposed to get a piece of it, but after the Russian Revolution and the Russians pulled out of World War One, leaving the British and the French to fend for themselves, their mandate was canceled. So they got nothing. They were supposed to get a big hunk of northern Iraq in the area, the Armenian area, that kind of thing. If you look at a map, they got nothing. And there has been kind of a mandate mentality since things got really stirred up after World War II, as more and more and more Jews migrated to Israel, to Zionism came to the fore, what they call Zionism. Zionism was a move to move back to the area in Palestine. Palestine, remember, was a mandate to the British. And if you recall, if you've ever seen the movie Exodus, it's kind of a chronicle of the attempt to everybody trying to make their way to Palestine to get out of Europe and have their own country, which they were promised, by the way, by the British government. If you're aware of the Balfour Declaration, Balfour, who was a foreign secretary, if I remember right, issued essentially a letter saying, yes, the Zionist movement is for real, and a homeland should be carved out in Palestine for the Jews to use as the place of refuge so they could get away from the horrible things that happened during World War II. Spring forward, in 1945, we get the UN, and in 1947, we actually have Israel declaring independence after a revolt where basically the British were thrown out. If you'll recall, the British mandate there did not go well. In fact, there were groups in Israel. One of them was the Stern Gang. If you've ever heard of the Stern Gang, Barry, are you familiar with that?
I'm afraid that that's not ringing bells with me.
Okay, no. The Stern Gang was essentially a terrorist organization. The Stern Gang blew up the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. I don't remember the year now, but they blew up the King David Hotel, I think in 1946, maybe, because it was chock full of British officials who were restricting the movement of Jews into Palestine. Part of the whole deal with Exodus, the movie, was that ships were being stopped from porting in Palestine to unload Jews, because the British had decided it was too much of a powder keg, and if they were going to rule this thing, they needed to keep peace. And the only way to do it, because the Palestinians were up in arms over this huge influx of immigrants, sound familiar? And so what did the immigrants do? Well, they came in, and the mentality was, of course, never again. If you've heard that phrase, that came from some very prominent Zionists who were said, we're never going to see another Holocaust again, and we're going to make sure that doesn't happen. And part of that assurance was forming their state in Palestine. And so the King David Hotel was blown up by, I think, the Stern Gang. The Stern Gang may have been wiped out by then, but its remnants all went into other organizations. But one of the people who was prominently involved in blowing up the King David Hotel was, have any idea? former Prime Minister Menachem Begin. Begin was prominently involved in blowing up the King David Hotel. Shimon Peres was involved in some of that stuff. A lot of the older people of I don't know where Golda Meir was in some of this, but she was involved in some of the actions that took place after independence. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these people were big names in Israel because of what they'd done to make sure that Israel, when it declared independence. Now, this might be compared to what was one of the first countries that recognized Israel as an independent government. It was
the U.S.
The United States of America, yeah.
Of course. Now, it's interesting because after this announcement by Trump, there's just basically been a roll of countries that are jumping on board. Czech Republic has followed suit. They basically are now saying that, yes, it's the Jerusalem's the capital. In a quote, they said, "The Czech Republic, together with other EU member states, following the EU Foreign Affairs Council conclusions, considers Jerusalem to be future capital of both states, meaning the state of Israel and the future state of Palestine." So, you know, they're still moving on a two-state solution, and with Jerusalem basically being a bifurcated capital.
Well, we'll see if the Palestinian state ever happens. Honestly,
yes.
What was supposed to happen was, under the mandate, the Palestinian state was supposed to be Jordan. So a lot of Palestinian refugees who were moving out to avoid the Jewish immigration went to Jordan and made such a stink and made themselves so odious that they were thrown out. Now, one of the problems is that people say they're going to take in Palestinians, and they do, and then they don't want them anymore. Why? Well, because they're radicalized. And that is very difficult for governments to deal with, because the same things Europe is seeing. You know, I would be surprised if the English or the British jumped on this bandwagon. Remember, they have a long, as I just explained, they kind of have a long and not too healthy history with the whole Arab-Israeli thing. And right now, Britain is on its way to becoming a very large minority Muslim country.
Mm-hmm. True.
So, are those kind of geopolitics going to play out in this thing? You bet they are. The fact is that what has happened is this whole mess has been just knocked off dead center. Nobody's relaxed about what's going to happen. And there's going to be a lot of kicking and screaming before this whole mess gets straightened out. But the fact is that, recognition, Barry, I had to laugh yesterday because I pop up my homepage on the internet is Yahoo. I don't know why. Just because every once in a while I can catch something that is interesting, or, you know, when they're in their news feed. Well, what did their news feed say? It said that Trump had declared Jerusalem the capital of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I laughed about that. Trump doesn't have the power to declare anything in Israel. He's not the president of Israel. What they should have said in their headline, and actually they did correct it later, because I'm sure they heard about it. They should have heard about it. It said, declare, he recognizes the capital as Jerusalem. Okay, Trump can do that. But he certainly can't declare the capital is Israel. Once again, assigning powers to the president that he doesn't have, and wishing that Hillary had been the one, because she wouldn't have made this mistake. You're right, she wouldn't have. She'd have gladly taken Jewish votes, people who vote both in United States elections and in Israeli elections, because Israel allows that. She would not have recognized Jerusalem as the capital. Because, basically, because for some reason the Democrats have hooked their star to the Palestinian wagon. Poor downtrodden people and blah, blah, blah. If you look, these poor downtrodden people, I'm amazed at how many people don't know that there are Palestinian members of the Israeli Knesset. It depends on the neighborhood. Palestinians generally don't get elected prime minister. That's because they aren't a majority of the seats, but they do hold seats. So do they have a voice in government? Yes, they do. Would Jews have a voice in government in a Palestinian state? Well, we don't know for sure, but I would be willing, as my mother used to say, bet you dollars to donuts, the answer would be a no.
Yes.
In fact, it would probably be a strongman government. It would have a, my guess is, top down. because that is a, you know, we all tend to implement our theology to government. And the fact is, we would not have a representative government. We would have a faux representative. There would be members of a parliament of sorts, and it would be a rubber stamp for the strong man who would sit at the top. You know, that's what Yasser Arafat wanted. He wanted to be the dictator of the new Palestinian state. Let's not kid ourselves. So do I understand totally what's going on there and all the ins and outs? No, let's not kid ourselves. Does this really have anything to do with current American thinking on the church, is what I'm thinking of, on eschatology? Okay. Well, it looks like it does, but it doesn't. And I say that as a post-millennialist.
Okay, sure.
I'll say that right out front. No, it's because Israel is not a religious state. It is a secular state, which is why Palestinians can have a seat in the Knesset, because it's not a theocracy. It's not a religious-based state. Israel has lots and lots and lots of people who view themselves as racially Jewish and are not believers. Now, do I think that Judaism is a separate race? No, I don't. I think you'll find that there's a lot of Jews who basically aren't direct descendants from Abraham. The racial lines have all blurred, but we'll just have to watch it. Is there going to be conflict over this? Oh, Barry, there's going to be huge conflict over this. I wouldn't be surprised if some bombings didn't start. And like you mentioned before, the embassies are all on alert, and embassies in countries where there's a large Muslim minority, especially that have been radicalized, I would say Germany, Greece, Italy, England better be on the lookout. Spain had better be on the lookout. Now, some of the other places I expect to recognize as well would be places where they're trying to stave off Muslim refugee immigration because of what they're seeing in other countries. Well, the Czech Republic's one of those. Poland is another. Some of the Central European countries, Hungary. I would guess that they would probably jump on the bandwagon and also recognize Jerusalem. Keep a sharp watch on that. Where you're not going to see it is countries who are essentially trying to juggle. They want desperately to juggle Palestinian and Israeli interests and not make their large Muslim minorities angry.
Well, absolutely. I think that there's going to be a lot to play out, but I think this announcement is part of a larger strategy to bring people to the table with the anticipation that it's going to happen. The U.S. is going to recognize it. It's going to happen. And so, therefore, changing some of the terms of the negotiations, possibly to get past some loggerheads. Now, why do I say this? Because so far, even though the liberal left and many of the never-Trumpers believe that the man's insane and he just does stuff off the cuff and he doesn't fully understand or grasp or appreciate the repercussions, I think that he understands very well what the repercussions could be. And I think that he is absolutely designing this as part of a larger strategy for the foreign policy. You know, again, as he said, he's keeping campaign promises, Chuck, because it's starting to look like when he said he was going to do something, he does it, as opposed to other candidates in the past and other officials who say things to get you to vote for them, but then give you excuses after the fact of why it can't happen. He's blowing the lid off of this whole thing, and that's the reason why people like Mitch McConnell and others hate him, why the Republicans are scared to death of the Steve Bannon influence out there running candidates like Roy Moore and Danny Tarkanian and Kelly Ward down in Arizona. It's the reason why guys like Tom Corker, Jeff Flake are all leaving, who are retiring early, who are getting out of Dodge because they realize that everything's changing. Now, there's good, you know, again, in desperation, when an old system is about to collapse under for a new system, there's a lot of desperation and a lot of pushback, and that's what you're seeing right now. But I think, again, Trump's a guy who, honestly, they haven't figured it out yet. He doesn't care.
Yeah,
he's president of the United States, and he recognizes that fact, but he also recognizes that he had a life before being president, and he'll have a life after being president. And what he's doing is, okay, I've told you this is why I ran for president, and this is why I thought I needed to be here, and I'm doing what I thought I need. And guess what? That's all that's going to take place.
Yeah.
Is I'm going to do what I told you I was going to do. And that's the reason why you've got this, and I still see it on my social media feeds. All of these people around the state of Ohio who have been never Trumpers and are still never Trumpers, there comes a point, Chuck, and you and I both, neither one of us were Trump supporters.
No.
Neither one of us, you know, was comfortable with him. Neither one of us, you know, really considered that. I don't think neither one of us until the nomination considered that, you know, he would be the candidate. But not only was a candidate, he's now the president. And I'll tell you what, in the last 10 months, Chuck, 11 months since he took office, I haven't been too disappointed with most of what he's done. And the couple of things that he did kind of stupidly, he kind of backtracked on, you know?
Yeah.
The initial attacking of the Freedom Caucus folks, that's now changed. And now the Freedom Caucus, I think, works much more closely with him and his administration. You know, the people that were giving him bad advice early on about who his friends and enemies were are no longer there in the administration. You know, they've gotten the boot. People who won't do the job that he puts them in there to do are getting the boot. I mean, you know, that's as a CEO of a major multinational corporation, sometimes you've got to shake things up in order to get the momentum going for the changes you need to make. And he understands that. And to him, I don't believe many of these are personal. He's having some fun with jabbing some of the liberals and even some of the establishment Republicans like the Paul Ryans and the Mitch McConnells of the world. And but I think, again, it's all part of I've got a greater goal here and I know where I'm going to. And just because you haven't figured it out yet doesn't mean that I'm wrong. And so this whole thing with the recognizing Jerusalem to be the capital of Israel and having our foreign policy decisions and even to the point of where we place an embassy, that's important. You know, it's important as part of the strategy. It's important to send the message across the political spectrum that he's doing what he believes to be important and right and what he promised people he would do. I mean, I know the pro-life community is pretty happy with him. Pro-religious liberty folks are starting to get happier with him because, you know, the Trump administration filed an amicus brief, and that was the other thing that was happening Tuesday while he was announcing that, you know, Jerusalem, right down the street at the Supreme Court, and I was there, Chuck. I went out to D.C., I was there at the steps of the Supreme Court building where a big rally of pro-life and pro-family folks were going on to support the attorneys and praying for the justices in deciding what's called the Masterpiece Cakes decision, or the cakes. And that was the case of a baker in Colorado by the name of Jack Phillips who chose not to bake a wedding cake for a same-sex, quote-unquote, marriage. And was sued under Colorado's anti-discrimination rubric by two homosexual males who honestly have now come out and said that it's never about the cake, it's never about anything else. It's really about whether or not they can force someone to go against their beliefs, that someone has to accede to what they want. I heard this coming as I'm coming into D.C. I'm hearing this on the radio that, you know, they made this statement that this isn't about a cake and it isn't about whether or not they got served or not. It was about forcing people to accept what they wanted. Now, after the fact, Chuck, when the oral arguments were heard Tuesday morning, by Wednesday morning, I was seeing articles on both sides, both in the Huffington Post from the liberal side and, like, you know, ADF and World Magazine and conservative commentators on the right, both basically feeling that, A, the decision's going to be up to Anthony Kennedy as the swing vote, and B, that based upon how Anthony Kennedy was addressing and attacking arguments, that he might side with religious liberty on this one. Now, I'm not holding my breath because, Kennedy's on his way out the door, okay? He's there. He was going to retire last year, but when Neil Gorsuch came, we were going to retire before the end of this year, but when Neil Gorsuch came on the court, Gorsuch begged him to stay on, at least for a little while, so that they could set a precedent of a new thing of having a sitting justice and his law clerk become a sitting justice and serve together on cases. Because that's really, Gorsuch was a clerk for Kennedy way back when. I think it's probably one of the worst decisions I've ever heard Gorsuch make was that plea to keep Kennedy on the court. But probably Kennedy is going to be stepping down after this term. And so that means sometime next summer, it looks like the president's going to get an opportunity to nominate another Supreme Court justice. Maybe two, depending on Ruth Bader Ginsburg's health, and or more, depending on acts of God in relation to the other justices and their aging and their health, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But going on to this, even the liberal commentators, and especially the pro-homosexual commentators, are beside themselves these last couple of days because they think they've lost. From the tone of the arguments and from the way the case was directed, and the things they were looking for, they really feel that there's a good high likelihood that religious liberty is going to trump the tolerance dictates and the tyranny of the left. And I can't say that could be any happier about that, Chuck. I mean, it's about time. You know, there has to, the courts have been instrumental in fomenting the undermining and the destruction of, you know, Western civilization in this arena in the United States with many of these social rulings. And honestly, if Anthony Kennedy is going to do something on his way out the door, trying to restore that balance might actually be a good thing.
Yeah, I look forward to the ruling. I'm not necessarily because I think it's going to necessarily be in the correct favor of the cake maker. But because I want to see what the prevailing reaction will be. And by that I mean that could be the impetus for if Kennedy does leave. And it's looking now like some of the more liberal members like Ruth Bader Ginsburg are basically going to have to be carried out on a shield. But some of the more liberals, how are they going to deal with it if Kennedy quits and Trump replaces him? Now, you know what will happen. The media will come out and say, you must replace him with another moderate. Well, no, I don't have to do that. In the same way that Obama did not have to replace anybody with anything but a screaming liberal. The same way that Clinton didn't have to replace anybody with a screaming liberal. I'm looking forward to seeing how this particular pot would be stirred. Because I'm happy when the pot gets stirred. It's like we've been on dead center for many, many decades, and it's sort of like it's time to get the machine moving again. Are we going to go one way or are we going to go another? And that's what I want to know.
Well, that's a good point. And I think that if any indications are correct, it looks like we're going to be turning the wheels and moving back in a correct direction, at least with this court decision. Yeah. Now, again, like so many others, this will be, if it does come out the way to support religious liberty, that'll be the one that states will say, we have to defy the courts. you just see it coming. You know, that's the way it gets down to.
And you know what? Here's, as a true Federalist, which I am, I happen to agree with the states. If they want to create these little dictatorships within their borders, within bounds, they're allowed to do that. In other words, I have no trouble with New York, the state of New York, banning guns. If they're that stupid, then they have the right to be stupid. And if the people are stupid enough to continue to elect representatives who will ban guns in those states, then then do it. But don't boo-hoo and tell me I have to do it too. Don't pull a Mike Bloomberg and send people in to try to set up illegal gun buys to point out the need for federal enforcement. No, there is, should be no federal enforcement. The federal government is enjoined. And don't play the well-regulated militia game with me. I know what a well-regulated militia is. It is a well-trained group of non-called-up people who are ready to be called up into military service at a moment's notice to handle revolts and insurrections and emergencies in your state. That is what a militia is. And regulation has to do with training. It does not have something to do with, by the way, and training is under the purview of the federal government, according to Article 1. And the fact is that it doesn't say that regulation means you can take their guns away. It says you can train them. In other words, you can set forth the kind of training and the kind of weapons that individuals should own. Not should not own, what they should own. In other words, the federal government can say you all have to have certain caliber weapons capable of certain kinds of fire at a minimum. So that, if you think about it, what a great idea that is. You already have a weapon that you can take up with you that meets a requirement so that we could all have fire the same ammunition in a situation where the militia would have to be called into federal service. That's not a bad plan. Should we all be firing NATO 556 ammo or 7.62 ammo? That kind of thing. Yeah, we need to have some uniformity so that we can, if everybody's called up and you have to bring your weapon, guess what? You can already fire the readily available ammunition for the defense of the United States. That's the whole point behind a militia and the whole regulation of the militia. That's what regulation meant. It didn't mean you could take the guns away. So, you know, that kind of thing. That's the kind of thing, these questions I want answered. And I want, if we're going to have a gun control debate or any other kind of a debate on religious liberty or anything else, let's do it from a level playing field, not the let's ban these things and then talk about whether we should reinstitute them. No, thank you.
No, absolutely not. You know, and that's the House passed the NRA concealed carry reciprocity bill. But the problem is it looks like the Senate may try to jam the Cornyn, Feinstein, Schumer legislation on gun control and bump stocks. You know, Tom Massie, who's the head of the Second Amendment Caucus in Congress and who's a libertarian Republican legislator from Kentucky, screamed bloody murder and voted against it, not just because of the Cornyn threat, but because of basically handing $625 million more dollars to states over the next 5 years to expand the background check database. Chuck, I don't know about anybody else, but when it comes to my personal protection, I don't believe it's the government's business as to what I have and what I don't have. Because it's, again, I believe that's the private decision, which is the reason why I refuse, regardless of how easy people have made it, and it's not easy, you got to take lots of training and things, to get a concealed carry permit, because again, it's still a permit, which puts you in a database, which then can be utilized to
confiscate.
Take away your
yes.
guns and your rights to hold those guns and to confiscate. And with the metadata situations we have in the country where, you know, you can have data mining across different platforms and across different databases, if you ever have a situation where, you know, you go in and because you're not feeling well, or you maybe got a little depressed over the holidays, seasonal affective disorder, whatever, and you maybe got a prescription for an antidepressant of some sort. Well, you know, in some areas, California being one and others, if you're diagnosed with what's considered a mental health issue, you forfeit your right to possess and own firearms.
It's ridiculous, but that's the way it is.
So that's part of the reason why I refuse to go and get my quote-unquote concealed carry permit. I don't believe it's the government's right to, you know, tell me that I can't own, possess, or carry personal protection, or that if I do, that I have to get some kind of paper where the government is okay me to do it. That's a violation of my Second Amendment rights. But again, this is that whole thing where we start down a road of being unconstitutional, and then we just add more policies on top of it to try to lessen the impact of it being an unconstitutional infringement. You know, so national reciprocity for concealed carry is all fine and well if you get past the idea that requires that saying that you're required to register your firearms or yourself as a carrier with a government entity, i.e. law enforcement, is constitutional. It's not. There's nothing in the Second Amendment. I guess they take the term well-regulated militia to mean well-regulated as state knows everything you've got, knows where it's located, and tells you how you can use it. That's well-regulated from a government standpoint now.
Well, that's
so exactly. I agree. Yeah. I agree with Tom Massey in voting against this bill. It's patently unconstitutional. And if you're going to be consistent, be consistent.
Well, Gun Owners of America has been arguing, and I think they're correct, that basically this expansion of the background check.
Yes.
Basically, that's what it amounts to is a traffic ticket gun ban.
Yeah,
and
it is.
And states will do that, and so will the federal government. If for instance, a Hillary-like person, Hillary is done, she'll never be president of the United States. But if a Hillary-like person, if Joe Biden, for instance, would become president of the United States, we would see expansion of that authority if that portion of the bill ends up in the final conference version and it's signed by President Trump. You will see expansion for minor misdemeanors, keeping you from getting a, which means that almost nobody would be able to get a gun because, let's face it, we've all had a traffic ticket. I mean, I know I have. It's been many, many, many years, and thank the Lord for that. But I made an illegal left turn, I think was my last traffic ticket on the campus of Michigan State University, which tells you it's been a while. I think like 1988 or 89 was my last traffic ticket. Nonetheless, that could keep me from being able to carry a gun concealed because I'll be quite unlike you. I have gone through the training and I do have a concealed carry permit, and whether or not I carry is nobody's business. Except under the current law, I'm required to notify a police officer if I'm carrying one when I'm stopped. And I don't think that's a bad idea anyway, but I don't like it being part of the law. I would tell a policeman, yes, I'm a concealed carry permit holder, and I do have one in the car.
You can hear me. Well, you know, and I appreciate that fact, Chuck, and that's fine, except that, you know, where I live, I'm down here on the border with a little state called West Virginia, and West Virginia has a little program statewide that's called constitutional carry.
Yeah.
And constitutional carry means it's your right. It's a Second Amendment right. Guess what? You don't even have to have paperwork. If you want to carry, you want to carry anywhere you want to carry, carry it. Now, of course, there are some businesses that will post that, you know, non-carry, but when it gets right down to it, I don't have to frequent those businesses if I choose not to.
Exactly. I just
have to wonder, swinging all the way back around to what we talked about Masterpiece Cakes, if I go into a business that's posted not carry and I'm carrying and they refuse to serve me, I then sue them and force them to serve me because they're violating, because that's part of who I am is my gun, or my right to carry is greater right than their right to refuse service to me. So I'm kind of wondering, you know, if the Masterpiece Cakes decision goes the wrong way,
for religious liberty, maybe it's a way to utilize it to make something good happen on that side of the situation. You know, if I have a right to get what I want based upon how I feel about it, which is basically the whole crux of the argument with same-sex marriage, then why shouldn't that extend to my right to walk into a facility or a store with my 380 strapped to my hip, or my 45, or whatever it might be, or my 223, or my AK-47 slung across my shoulder?
Yeah, there's a...
See, it's, you have to think about these things in that way, because if we're going to say that, you know, someone has a right to force somebody to do something that they find objectionable, this could turn on liberals as well.
The only problem is you're going to have a very difficult time finding a judge to rule in your favor. And that's the difference.
Oh, well, of course. Yeah.
When you turn your judiciary, or when you turn over your lawmaking capabilities to your judiciary, which is what we have done in this country, that's what you can expect. You can expect unfair, unreasonable, in fact, stupid rulings which make law, rather than rulings which essentially go along with the spirit of the law. Do the courts have the right to not enforce law that they deem unconstitutional? Yes. Do they have the right to force other courts not to enforce those laws? The answer is no. That was never part of the constitutional plan, and that included the Supreme Court. Remember, there's an old saying in law, and again, I'm not an attorney and I don't play one on TV, but that is that decisions are applied to the litigants. Can they be used as a guide? Yes. But this thing about stare decisis, if you'll recall, we had long, hard arguments even with other pro-lifers about this stare decisis idea. And I can remember talking to our friends over at the Mike Perutka. About he did some very important stuff on what stare decisis meant and what it didn't mean, and it's an important distinction to lay out what the courts are permitted and are not permitted to do. And the fact is that under our constitutional system, the Congress has the right to regulate within bounds, within constitutional bounds, what cases the courts can hear. Now, again, the courts have been reluctant to do this, except in places where, for instance, recently, we talked about this about a little over 20 years ago, Tom Daschle stuck one of these provisions, a no-review provision, in a forestry bill that affected his constituents. And what he did was he basically said the Supreme Court has no right to review this particular part of the law. Well, could he do that? And the answer is yes, he could. He had the power to regulate that because it wasn't in the Supreme Court's specifically laid out jurisdictional areas, which have to do with maritime law, have to do with battles between states. And in fact, John Roberts came out and said something that was totally ridiculous, and several of the other Supreme Court justices came out and said ridiculous things. In that, remember when the states were going to sue the federal government over Obamacare back in the days,
right,
before they got bribed out of it with what amounts to Medicare money. They were bribed out of it, but they were going to sue the federal government, and the Supreme Court says, we will not directly hear a case. Well, the fact is, according to the Constitution, they couldn't refuse to directly hear a case because they have original jurisdiction in cases between the states and the federal government.
No, well, what they said was, we won't take it up first. You have to go down through the lower courts. But that's not what original jurisdiction is.
No, sure isn't. They have to hear the case, period. And the fact is, there were enough states that the Supreme Court basically realized that they would have been forced to find in favor of the states because it was clearly unconstitutional. And they would have had to take original jurisdiction, so they just basically said, we won't take the case. Well, you can't do that. You can't refuse the case. But they did. And what did Congress do about it? Nothing. What Congress always does about rogue judges? Nothing. My mother's representative in Congress is a guy named Al C. Hastings.
I feel for her.
Yes. Al C. Hastings is a impeached and removed federal judge. What was he impeached and removed for? Corruption. What did he do? He turned around and ran for Congress in an ultra-liberal district. That's which my mom is stuck in. Down in Florida. It's in West Palm Beach. And so, folks, have we had impeachments of federal judges? Yes. Have we done it for the right reasons? Well, in some cases, yeah. Al C. Hastings was correctly removed from office for being a grafter. But we don't seem to have the guts to remove them for being innovative in constitutional interpretation, which is one of the things that the impeachment process was designed for.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is where we are. And this is where we're going to have to start thinking. These are one of the things we're going to have to start thinking about when we seriously talk about draining the swamp. Because you're not going to be able to drain the swamp without draining the judicial swamp.
Amen.
And how are we going to do that? Well, yeah, here's the problem. You have to elect a Congress with guts. And none of these guys have it. Although, let's just say that some are beginning to develop intestinal fortitude, especially in the Freedom Caucus area, because we have a president who basically is willing to do what he said he would do. Now, is he completely right on some of the people he sticks in jobs? No, I think in some cases, like his chief of staff in the White House, I think that guy should go. Who knows? We need to see. Trump doesn't necessarily understand all the nuances of what he's dealing with Congress and the courts and the swamp. But he's learning. And he's got people out there as liaisons who are giving him the correct information. And he's weighing it out. And let's face it, he hasn't been in office a year yet, so he's got a lot of stuff to learn.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this thing with the Mueller investigation now, which is beginning to unravel because it's becoming clear that the Russia collusion thing is a joke. Now he's basically, to justify his existence, he's got to expand out beyond the bounds of the original investigation. Well, who can rein that in? Congress can. Do they want to? I don't know. We should basically be asking our congressmen, look, rein this thing in. Keep it where it's supposed to be. Why are you prosecuting former members of Trump's staff for things that you refuse to prosecute Hillary's staff for when you have had direct evidence of them lying to the FBI? We have direct evidence of a former FBI director who wrote an exoneration of Hillary Clinton before he'd actually looked at any of the evidence or when the investigation wasn't complete yet. We have a special prosecutor who's hiring people who were involved in covering that up for the former FBI director. Barry, this is swamp rattery in its highest form.
You're correct.
Yeah, swamp rattery. Well, maybe I should say its highest form, in its lowest form. Yes. My apologies for getting that wrong. In its lowest form. So what do we got to do about it? Well, we got to keep on our representatives. And let's face it, we have in Ohio, it's interesting. We in my district, anyway, because my congressman, who was a swamp rat extraordinaire, and that's Pat Tiberi, is resigning. And he's hoping to control who gets his seat. And I know we're almost out of time, but we got a couple of minutes. Maybe you want to go over that while we got 2 or 3 minutes left.
Yeah, that's true, Chuck. There's an awful lot of people who are lining up for that particular seat. Some of the announced candidates so far, the ones who said that they're interested in it, include the Delaware County Prosecutor, Kelly O'Brien, who many people think that's who the T-Berry camp's getting behind. But we've just had the announcement today that a state senator, Troy Balderson, from over in the Zanesville area, is announcing a run for it. Kevin Bacon, who's also a senator from Westerville, state senator, who's wanting to jump in. A couple of businessmen who've made some interest. There are some local activists and local officials, a township trustee in Orange Township, which is the largest township in Delaware County, which is the county that's the most populous in the district. You know, full county. He comes in and gets part of Franklin County with Westerville in that congressional seat, but that doesn't count. But so she's involved, and she's probably, you know, as far as I can tell right now, one of the most conservative members, and has already run afoul of the T-Berry camp already over some local issues. So obviously he's not going to be supporting her candidacy. But yeah, that's the thing. You know, you're going to have this situation where these guys who are leaving office because they've realized that the gravy train's over with, and that Trump's not going to play ball with them like the previous administrations or leadership. You know, part of Pat T-Berry's problem is that John Boehner is no longer Speaker of the House. So therefore, Pat's not necessarily viewed with as much admiration by Paul Ryan as he was by John Boehner. So that gets him out. And then, of course, you know, you've got the situation with Jim Renacci running for governor, who just, it looks like today, is going to announce that Cincinnati City Councilwoman Amy Murray is going to be his running mate. It's not going to help him with any of the conservatives, because Amy Murray is a moderate Republican who's soft on core issues. I'm not sure what Renacci's doing, but honestly, I don't think he's I don't think the guy's ready for prime time when it comes down to this governor's run.
No, he's in the right place.
Mary Taylor is still in the race, even though just I believe it was last night, the Franklin County Republican Party, who's considered to be the powerhouse in the state now that the former Summit County Party leader has passed away, Alex Arshinkoff. So Doug Price and Brad Sennett, who basically run the Franklin County Republican Party and run and are behind all the John Kasich stuff, and who are the power brokers in Ohio Republican politics, came out last night, endorsed the DeWine Houston ticket, because they were the ones really responsible for making that happen and getting the two candidates together on a single ticket so they could try to save money and fight Rich Cordray, who just announced that he is going to be running for governor on the Democrat ticket. And that giant sucking sound, as Ross Perot would say, it was all the air being sucked out of the campaigns of every other Democrat that was running. So all four of the five, I guess, if you count Bill O'Neill, the state Supreme Court justice, who probably on Friday it will announce that he's stepping down from the court to focus on the run, because if not, he's going to probably get removed from the court by the legislature for basically violating the law in running for a partisan office while he's sitting on the court as a nonpartisan official.
Yeah.
And he's a Democrat. So, but Rich Cordray sucked all the air out of the room. And so basically the whole thing now is jockeying to figure out which one of the announced, if he goes that way, announced candidates is going to end up being his running mate. And my guess is it's Nan Whaley, the Democrat mayor of Dayton, whose big thing right now is sanctuary cities. So obviously, you know, there's going to be some headache about that, and that's going to be a focus of national politics for a while. And so I think Cordray is trying to bank on getting a lot of votes from both legal and illegal immigrants in relation to, you know, protecting the illegals who are here among us now versus actually upholding the law.
All right.
Not surprised with Rich Cordray.
We got to bring this to an end because we're out of time.
Okay. So basically, when it gets right down to it, there's an awful lot of things that are happening right now. A lot of coal in people's socks. The Franklin County Party, in endorsing DeWine and Houston, just put coal in the sock of Mary Taylor and Jim Renacci. They also endorsed Mike Gibbons for the United States Senate run over Josh Mandel. That was a personal hit, too. Because that's payback to Mandel for not endorsing John Kasich for president.
Yeah.
He endorsed Marco Rubio and then Donald Trump. So therefore, a lot of coal's being distributed. Christmas can't come soon enough. And honestly, politically, Christmas is going to be in May next year, when many of these establishment Republicans are probably going to wonder what hit them.
Yes.
Because I don't see the Trump phenomena failing in the midterm elections.
No. Okay. Now you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. You can make a comment. You can listen to past shows. All of them are up and available for listening. And we would ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.